My dear Commander Buell, I am very much pleased to hear that you are going to write the biography of Fleet Admiral King. I had the pleasure of serving with him on two occasions, and I had a great deal of respect for him. I'm also very pleased that you have written the biography of Admiral Spruance. I served with him when I had command of Iowa during World War II. I worked alternately under Halsey and Spruance, and I remember very well when I went out to sea with Spruance, we knew exactly what we were going to do, where we were going to do it, and how we were going to do it. When we went out with Halsey, we didn't know where we were going, we didn't know what we were going to do, and we certainly didn't know how we were going to do anything. Everything we did seemed to be a surprise to us. And you may remember that Halsey always took his press aboard with him. So far as I know, Spruance never had any press with him whatsoever. As a consequence, Halsey was written up everywhere and gained praise in the press continuously, while Spruance was the silent admiral, as I think you possibly mentioned in your letter. I first ran across Admiral King in New London, Connecticut, when he had command of the submarine base. I had been selected to take a postgraduate course in diesel engineering design at Nuremberg in Germany, and was ordered to the base to wait orders while diplomatic arrangements were being made. When I arrived and Admiral King read my orders, he says, "Well, while you're waiting, you might just as well go to work, so I'm going to assign you to teach diesel engineering to the submarine students at the school." I taught diesel engineering. I found him quite a taskmaster. There wasn't any question about it. One of my lectures that I inherited was a three-hour lecture on the polygon of forces involved in the construction of diesel engineering, the bed plate proposition primarily. One of my students pulled out his watch along about the second hour, or perhaps half an hour later than that, and looked at it. Finally, another one did, and I could realize that they were getting bored. But then one officer took out his watch, and he put it up to his ear and shook it. And that really got me a little provoked. So I said, "I don't mind you looking at your watch. I've been looking at mine too." But I said, "When you have to shake it to see if it's stopped, I think probably my lecture is quite a bore." But I said, "You're going to get an exam on this lecture, so you better pay attention." But that night, I thought that lecture over very carefully, and I decided I'd split it up into two parts. So the next time that same lecture came around with the next class, I gave the students 20-minute intermission, a recess, so to speak. So they all went out into the yard outside of the school building, and Captain King saw them. Immediately, I got a call to his office, and he wanted to know what all those students were doing out in the open air and not under in the classroom. I tried to explain that lecture was so long that I thought that they were entitled to a recess. He says, "Get them back into the class and put them to work." So I put them back in the classroom and put them to work. On the third class I had, I gave them a recess all right, but I kept them out of sight. And from then on, we got along very beautifully. It was my habit usually to go in the main gate, drive in the main gate, and in time so that I could get to my office be on the job at exactly 8:30 in the morning. Invariably, as I drove in, I would meet Admiral King walking from the north gate toward his office. So as I passed, sitting in my car, I'd give him a good snappy salute, and he would return it likewise with a good snappy salute. Now, one morning, I was about 5 minutes late, and strange as it may seem, he also was late. But anyway, as I drove past him, I gave him the same good snappy salute, but this time I didn't get a return salute. His back was stiff as a ramrod, and he faced forward, stern expression on his face, but he failed to return my salute. He was telling me that I was quite in the wrong, although he wasn't going to admit that he was in the wrong also. Perhaps that was his method of admitting that he also was wrong. I don't know about that. But anyway, I was about 5 minutes late getting to the base, and I was probably maybe 5 or 6 minutes more than that later getting my office. He was a disciplinarian, without any doubt. I found out from my predecessor that he had his girls, of which there were six, lined up in front of their beds for inspection after breakfast every morning. He inspected the beds and so on in their rooms to see that everything was in shipshape order before he went to the office and before they went to school. That's typical of Admiral King. I taught at the diesel school for about a year, and then the chief engineer of the base was transferred, so he moved me up, as he called it, to the chief engineer of the base. And then from then on, I had quite a few troubles. A job involved the powerhouse and the generators and so on that charged the submarine batteries. And I had the fire department. I had all the duties that would ordinarily accrue to a first lieutenant of a ship. And one day I was sitting in I was in the powerhouse when the fire alarm rang. And I immediately ran to the office where the annunciators were located, and I found out that the fire was in the garage. So I dashed over there, and I got there just about the time the fire equipment arrived, and they put out the fire, which was located up in the overhead of the garage where some of the men had gathered, and they apparently had been smoking up there, and they left some cigarettes. But anyway, the fire was not too serious, but it could have been if the fire department hadn't arrived on time. And when the fire was out, Captain King called me up to his office, and I will avoid expletives. But he said, McCann, didn't you realize if that garage burned down that we would have gotten a newer and better one? Well, I said, Captain, the job you assigned me involved the charge of the fire department, and the duty of the fire department is to put out fires. Well, he said, you know, that's a pretty old garage there, and it's a fire hazard anyway, and we need a new garage. And I said, yes, Captain, but do you realize that your car was in that garage? He didn't even smile. I turned around and walked out of his office. Sometime later, the tender carried Admiral Christie, who was in command of the submarine force Pacific at that time, came in and tied up to the dock at the submarine base. A couple of days later, Commander Gilmore came to me and asked me if he could use a space in the garage to have his car overhauled by his men. Well, I said, no, I can't permit you to do that. That would be unreasonable. But he said, Admiral Christie has authorized me to use my men outside of working hours. Well, I said, puts a different aspect on it. And in that case, I think it's quite all right. So I assigned him the space. So they worked on his car a couple of days during the noon hour, and then after 4:30 in the afternoon. One day, Admiral King came storming into my office about 1:10 or thereabouts, and he bawled me out for a farewell. He laced me up and down and thwart ships in front of all of my staff, of which there were two or three officers that were present and about 20 stenographers and clerks. And he spared no words whatsoever. I tried to explain that Gilmore had Admiral Christie's permission, and he said, well, he said, what are you trying to do, run a private garage? And I tried to explain I couldn't. His face was white as a sheet, and he was really very mad. But as he started to depart, he said, come up to my office. So I followed him up to his office, and he kept me standing there while he sat down and laced me up and down some more. But anyway, I finally got back to my office. By that time, I was rip-roaring mad as I could be, because I felt that I was justified in doing what I had done, inasmuch as the Admiral had given Gilmore permission to have his car overhauled. Well, about an hour and a half went by, and finally Admiral King sent his orderly down and asked me to come up to his office. When I arrived in his office, he said, sit down, McCann. Well, you know, when Admiral King tells you to sit down in his presence, you can be sure that everything is quite all right. So I said, Admiral, he was captain at the time. I said, he said, McCann, he said, I've just been over talking to Admiral Christie. And he said, Admiral Christie said that everything was just as you said it was, that he gave Gilmore permission to have his car overhauled by Gilmore's men out of hours. And he said, I'm sorry for everything I said. And I said, I felt that it was quite all right. And he said, well, he said, I realize now that you were between the devil and the deep blue sea. And he says, I apologize for everything I said. I said, I thank you very much, Captain, for the apology, because I felt that I was quite right in what I did. So I turned on my heel and walked down to my office. About 10 minutes later, Captain King came into the office, and he said, ladies and gentlemen, he said, I want to apologize to all of you for what I said about an hour or so ago in addressing Commander McCann as I did. I was wrong, and I'm sorry, but he said, I have a terrific temper, and sometimes it gets entirely out of control. So I offer my apology to you and to Commander McCann for that outbreak. And he turned and walked on his heel. Well, now, that took courage. He's a disciplinarian, but I've never known Admiral King to treat anybody unfairly. And if he did, he always apologized for it. Sometime later, I had command of the USS N4. She was a lake-type submarine, and I was operating out of New London only for a very short time when I was ordered to Newport. along with the R-9, which was a Holland-type submarine, and we were ordered there to fire torpedoes and collect tactical data for curved fire. One day, while we were up there, I had the misfortune to hit a lighthouse entirely by accident. I had backed out of the torpedo station, and as you perhaps are aware, you can't back very far before you back into Newport. So I started out and finally got straightened out along the breakwater and was going very satisfactorily, so much so that I stopped the starboard motor and hooked down the starboard diesel engine. And as I was approaching the end of the breakwater where the lighthouse is located, my thumb-controlled rudder went hard left. But it was something that happened quite regularly, so I just ordered the engines to stop, and then I ordered back, a very simple operation. And nothing seemed to happen, so I ordered back emergency, but instead of that, I went full speed ahead, and I crashed the lighthouse almost at a normal angle of 90 degrees. Well, nothing happened to the submarine, but anyway, my second mate, in the meantime, had gone down below, but he didn't get there quite in time. He took over the controllers, and we backed away, and I went back and tied up to my berth at Goat Island, and then went down the breakwater to the lighthouse. Well, there wasn't very much damage. There was a crack in the wall behind the kitchen stove, and it ran up the lighthouse a little way. So I decided that I would go in and see the captain right away. At that time, the station was commanded by Captain Sen, the father of a classmate of mine. I immediately asked for a board of investigation, and he convened it almost immediately. So within an hour, I had my board of investigation, and of course they found me responsible for the accident entirely, which I wholly expected. The difficulty was that the chief electrician had put on a new first-class electrician from another boat, and he'd been used to backing in a different direction. That is, since he'd been used to pushing the controls away from him in order to back, where on this boat you pull them towards you. So that was the answer to the difficulty. Excuse me. Well, anyway, I continued operating for about another week, and then I had to have battery water, which the station couldn't supply. So I went back to New London, and of course when I did, I reported to Captain King right away. I expected to get a real honest-to-goodness bawling out, and probably a court-martial for the incident. Well, I went up and reported. I tell you, I was shaking in my shoes. But when I got up there, Captain King said, "Sit down, McCann." Well, I was dumbfounded. And he said, "I understand you had a little accident there in Narragansett Bay involving a lighthouse." And I said, "Yes, I did." He said, "Didn't you know lighthouses are put up to warn people away?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I really do." Well, he says, "You know, that lighthouse should have been knocked down many years ago." He said, "It's a nuisance," and he said, it's been manned for a long time when they should have had a little bit of a light at the end there, unwatched. I said, "Well, I didn't want to be the one who did it. I thought they should use some kind of a construction crew to take that down. I didn't want to be responsible." Well, he said, think nothing of it. We'll drop the subject. So that was Ernie King again. Once again, fair and square as he could be. I think I better backtrack a little bit. I forgot to mention that I went to the base in 1924, which is something you would probably want to know. Another episode while I was there and before I went to the USS N4, there was a golf course on the base, and I had a terrible slice in playing golf, and the slice was such that whenever I made it, it went into Ernie King's yard, either the front yard or either one of the sides. I never dared go and get the ball. So I used to try to turn a little bit to the left so if I'd slice down the fairway instead of into his yard. But I wasn't the only one who sliced into his yard, so it wasn't long before Captain King issued an order that was illegal to slice into his yard. I didn't blame him very much because the youngsters used to play in the yard, and it was quite possible that one of them might get hit. But later on, I noticed when he was playing, I'd see a ball that he had just driven some on some from some tee that had my name on it. You know, I was always tempted to pick it up, but then I didn't dare. As I have said before, my duties involved the powerhouse. But the first time I had any trouble with the powerhouse was when I'd first taken over my duties. I was at home. It was about 10:30 at night. My telephone rang. It was Captain King on the phone. He said, my lights are out, and hung up. Well, the only thing I could do, I didn't know why these lights were out, but I got on the phone, I called the powerhouse, and I said, what's the matter with the power up at Captain King's house? And he says, we've lost suction on the circulators. And I said, why have you lost suction? He says, well, the tide is so low that we can't get a suction. I said, I'll be right up. So I drove from the southern part of New London all the way across the river and up through Groton to the base, and I found out that that's just exactly what had happened. So I started questioning and found out that we had a lake, a pond up in the hills, and all they had to do was to open up a valve and bring the water down from the pond and put the circulators on atmospheric exhaust and use the water from the pond until the tide came up. So it was a simple solution, but I asked the warrant officer who had in charge of the watch why he didn't do it. He said, well, it's so hard to grind the valves afterwards. Well, I said, from now on, when that power fails due to lack of circulating water, that's what you do. You go on atmosphere exhaust immediately. So I issued an order, a written order, and put it on the bulletin board that any time the tide was low so that they lost circulating water from the river, that they'd be go on atmosphere exhaust. That settled that, but nevertheless, every once in a while, Captain King called and said, my lights are out. So I had to use a little discipline with the watch officers before I got that problem solved. In the machine shop, I had a very old and very reliable first-class machinist mate, colored. he came to me one day and he said, Commander, I'd like to have 10 days leave if I can to go to Philadelphia to see my family. I haven't had leave now in almost a year. Well, I said, you're entitled to it if that's the case. He said, I said, I'll break out your record and if and check your leave record, and if you're entitled to it, I'll take you up to Mass to the captain, and I'm sure he'll grant it. So I broke out his record, and sure enough, he hadn't had leave for almost a year, so I took him up to the Mass, and captain gave him a leave right away, so I wrote up his papers and signed them, and he went on leave. Well, he came back on time, clean and sober, went back to work. But in about 5 or 6 days, he came back to me and he says, Commander, he says, can I have 10 days more leave? Well, I said, of course. I said, you're entitled to it. You haven't had your 30 days. But I said, what do you want leave so soon for? He said, I want to get married. I said, I thought you just went to see your family. Well, he says, I did, but he says, you know, he says, if you've been living with a woman and have 6 children for 20 years, he said, it's about time you ought to get married. Well, I said, I'll take you up to the captain, but I don't know what he's going to say about that. But I took him up to the Mass, and I explained the thing to the captain, and I think it was the first time Captain King, I'd ever seen Captain King really laugh. But he started to smile, then he started to laugh, and then actually he went into stitches. And he said, when he finally calmed down, he looked at this man and he says, permission's granted, but he says, when you come back, you bring a marriage certificate with you, properly dated. The man came back on time with a marriage certificate, properly dated and signed, and properly signed. He really meant it. Well, I think, as you are aware, after Captain King left the submarine base, he went to aviation, and for a while I lost track of him entirely. In the meantime, of course, I went to other duties also. So I didn't run across him until, after I'd been in the Bureau of CNR, where I invented the McCann Submarine Rescue Chamber. And after that, went to command of the USS Bonita, the old submarine V-3. Then at that time, Captain King had command of the Lexington. We had, I ran across him then on a entry into San Francisco Bay, and as was usual, the submarines led the fleet into San Francisco Harbor. That was the usual procedure. I went immediately to my assigned berth, anchored, and had gone below to get some rest, because we'd had pretty arduous duties during the war games and so on. And my signalman called down and said, I have a message from the Lexington. Shall I call it down to you? And I said, yes, go ahead. The message read, Lexington to Bonita, get underway immediately. You are anchored in my berth. Well, of course, that got me right out of my bunk right away, and I dashed up to the bridge, and I took bearings again, or at least my navigator did. And my navigator said, Captain, you're exactly in the position assigned by our orders. So I sent a message right away, Bonita to Lexington, have rechecked my bearings and am exactly in position assigned to me by this order, number so-and-so. A few minutes elapsed, Lexington to Bonita, get underway. You are anchored in my berth. Well, then I took the bearings, and I checked them very carefully, and I got the same results the navigator did. So I sent another message, Bonita to Lexington. Commanding officer has personally checked bearings. Find them exact, and I find my I'm anchored in my berth assigned to me by order number so and so. A few minutes later, King to McCann, get underway. You're in my berth. So it became personal then. So I rechecked the bearings, and I rechecked them again and again, and I still found that I was in exact berth. So then I wrote out a message, McCann to King, have checked and rechecked my bearings, and find that I am in exact berth assigned to me. This berth is much too small for Lexington. I waited a while on the bridge, expecting another dispatch from him. Nothing came for at least 10 minutes. Then a message, King to McCann, sorry, my navigator made a mistake. I would hate to be his navigator on that particular occasion. Time, I went to other duties. I was assigned to first lieutenant of the Indianapolis for a year, and then went to Admiral Taussig's staff as a first lieutenant and tactical officer, and from there to the Bureau of Navigation as officer planning under Richardson and then under Nimitz. While I was there, I got a letter from Admiral King, who then had command of the Atlantic Fleet, asking me to come as his to his staff as operations officer. I had just come from a staff, and I didn't want to go to another staff. I wanted to finish my shore duty, and besides, I was working under Admiral Nimitz at the time, and I wanted to stay with Admiral Nimitz because, for a very good reason, Admiral Nimitz was an awful good officer to work under. So I went to Admiral Nimitz, and I told him the story, and I said, he said, well, you can't go anyway. He said, I want you to stay here with me and finish your tour. So he said, I'll write King a letter right away. Well, I said, will you please wait a couple of days and let me write him first, because I don't want him to think that you are holding me up. I want to explain why I don't want to go, and then you can explain why you don't want me to go. He said, that's fine. So I wrote Admiral King as nice a letter as I could, and then Admiral Nimitz wrote him a letter. So almost immediately I got a very nice letter back from Admiral King explaining or telling me that my point of view was quite correct, and that he would have me on his staff sometime later on. Well, that didn't happen for a long, long time. But anyway, I didn't run across him again then for quite a while. After my duty in the Bureau, I was assigned to Comm Submarine 6, which was to be organized in Portsmouth, and some of the ships were being built also on the west coast at Mare Island. And I arrived out in Pearl Harbor on the 25th of November 1941, and It was, of course, on the 7th of December when the Japs attacked. I was located just next to the Arizona and was on the bridge when I saw that bomb go down the stack of the Arizona. At that time, I was a full commander, but I was soon made a captain, and wasn't long after that I was made admiral. And when I was made an admiral, of course, Admiral King called for me right away to be his chief of staff for the 10th Fleet. When I reported to him, I said, Admiral, you know I'm a submarine officer. I'm not an anti-submarine officer. And he looked me up and down, and he said, well, McCann, I'm setting a thief to capture a thief. He said, go to work. Which is exactly what I did. I'd been in the office more than a few days when we got some information in regard to the location of some German submarines. So I went to him and asked permission to take two anti-submarine units out of Admiral Ingram's fleet. Admiral Ingram at that time had the Atlantic Fleet. Admiral King looked me up and down. He says, McCann, don't you ever do that again. He said, you are running the anti-submarine forces. And he said, you take any units out of Admiral Ingram's fleet you want, put them under your own command, order them wherever it's necessary to order them, and when you're through with them, return them to Admiral Ingram. He said, you can tell me the results afterwards. I thought myself right away, I said, well, I guess I am the boss. Admiral King was excellent when it came to delegating authority. I remember many episodes during the period that I was his chief of staff were in any respect unpleasant. We had a conference every single morning as to our estimate of the location of German submarines. I had a very excellent lieutenant commander who ran the board of the Atlantic area. Up to the chop line, as we called it, where the British took over. And Admiral King appeared every single morning at 9 o'clock to sit and listen to this lieutenant commander recite the locations of the submarine, just as though he knew exactly where they were, which is, I think he did. At least we made believe he did, anyway. And when the Germans finally capitulated, I found myself out of a job. So I spent a while looking over the papers of the 10th Fleet, sorting them out, getting the top secret material ready for destruction, as was normally expected of me. When Admiral King called me in and he said, I have a job for you. It's highly secret. So he got up from his desk and walked the full length of his very large office and closed the door and then went back and sat down. And he said, I have a mission for you. I want you to take Truman to the Potsdam Conference. The fact that he's going is very, very highly secret. And he said, I'm going to give you two cruisers, the Augusta and the Philadelphia. You will pick up the president in Newport News. The date is not at all certain, but except that the time of arrival has been set diplomatically as the 15th day of July, And that was 1945, and the time of arrival has been arranged as 10:15 a.m. on that date. You will have to judge your speed accordingly as to the time of arrival of the president at Newport News. You will proceed immediately, take command of the cruisers, and take them out to sea in order to have so that in order that there will be no leak whatever in regard to this mission. I immediately packed a bag, went to Hampton Roads, took command of the two cruisers, and ordered them out to sea immediately. There was great wonderment aboard both of the ships as to what we were going to do, but I didn't tell them anything about it whatsoever for fear that somebody might get ill and have to be sent hospitalized or something like that, and the word might get out before the president was out at sea. Both of the skippers were extremely puzzled. There was no question about that, and I rode the Philadelphia, and I know my skipper was very, very curious as to what it was all about. The trip was uneventful, both going and returning. Upon my return to Washington, I was still once more out of a job, but Admiral King called me in immediately, and he said, I have an assignment for you. You are to take command of the submarine force Pacific. Well, I was tickled to death with that. There was no doubt about it. It was one of the jobs that I particularly wanted. So when I said goodbye to Admiral King, that was my last real contact with him. I left him with a great deal of regret. There was no question about it. I had become very fond of the old man, and I say old man advisedly is because, as you know, the skipper, the boss, is always the old man. And I, in many ways, regretted leaving his command because although he was harsh, strict, I'd learned how to deal with him, and the rest of the staff did too. Savvy Cook, C.M. Cook was his chief of staff, as I think I mentioned before, and Dickie Edwards, his deputy. All knew how to deal with him, and it was a very, very pleasant tour of duty, and I enjoyed it very much. And as I said, I regretted very much leaving his command. As you know, of course, when the Japs had finally capitulated, he was relieved and retired, and then, as you know, shortly after that, had a stroke. I'll try now to answer a few of your questions, and perhaps I may think of something else that may be of interest to you. When I served with him in New London, I reported to him in July of 1924 and served until July 1926. The exact dates I do not have because I've lost my files. When I reported to him as Chief of Staff of the 10th Fleet, it was in November in 44. And I served with him until December in 45. Of course, that included the interlude when I took Truman to the Potsdam Conference. You ask, what were my duties? At New London, my first year there was teaching diesel engineering, and the second year I was chief engineer of the base. You ask, what was my relationship with the Admiral? Well, of course, at that time, at New London, he was a captain. And that's a hard question to answer. My relationship entirely was friendly. in my previous remarks, there were moments when they were distinctly unfriendly, but all duly corrected. With the 10th Fleet, extremely friendly completely amiable. You ask, how did he treat his subordinates? As I mentioned before, he was a very strict individual with his subordinates. He expected them to be on the job whenever they were supposed to be on the job. But he was also extremely strict with himself. He was on the job when he was supposed to be on the job, and sometimes on the job when he didn't have to be or didn't expect to be on the job. In other words, he was perfectly willing to spend a great deal of overtime in work, and he didn't necessarily expect his subordinates to work overtime unless their desks weren't cleared. And in that case, he did expect them to work. In other words, he wanted them to get their work done. You ask to describe his character and personality. Well, I don't think I just know how to do it any better than as I have done in the preceding discourse. I think as far as personality is concerned, I consider him a cold individual, actually. He was a strong character, a very, very strong character, but his personality was cold. I'd like to say he had a warm personality, and I think at times he did, but on the whole, I don't think he made friends easily, so I'd classify him primarily as a cold personality. You asked what his working habits were. He was on the job all day during working hours and sometimes far into the night. You asked what were his personal traits that led him to becoming CNO and Com Inch. I'll hark back to the time that I was planning officer in Bureau of Navigation, both under Richardson and under Nimitz. One of my duties at that time was perennial secretary of selection boards. And when Admiral King came up for admiral, I happened to be a secretary of that particular selection board. And one of my duties was to go through every one of the officers' records to see that there was no extraneous matter in the records that might be of interest to somebody other than the board itself. There were sometimes cases where somebody would slip something into a record that didn't belong there. But I noted in Admiral King's record from way back where an officer put down on his fitness report when he submitted it to the duty he particularly requested. And from the time he made captain, that duty he requested was CNO, Chief of Naval Operations. In every one of his fitness reports, he put down CNO. I think that gives an idea of the fact that that was the duty he wanted, and it also indicated that he was an ambitious individual. You asked what were his drinking habits. Occasionally, I used to go to a friend of mine, later Admiral Mayer, J.E. Mayer. Incidentally, one of his sons married my second daughter. And Admiral King would drop in occasionally, and he would have one highball and depart. I don't think he was a drinking man in any respect at all. Was he a family man? Yes, of course. He had six daughters before the son arrived. And when the son arrived, well, that was the end of his family. So he had ended up with seven children. But during the war, he abandoned his family for his duties, and he lived at the Navy Yard aboard a yacht that was stationed there. When I say abandoned, I don't mean to infer that there was any rift in the family. It was simply because of his devotion to duty and the fact that he felt that he should be in immediate communication with the Navy Department and have immediate access to the Navy Department from the gun factory.
You ask about his
brain and intellect. I considered him a very, very smart man. Frequently, I'd meet him in the chart room, which was a highly secret room, given access to only a very few of us. But frequently, he'd say, "Well, McCann," he said, "I noticed that your New Orleans and Charleston convoys made a juncture with your Halifax convoy and was turned over to the British without losing a ship. I'm glad to see you accomplish that without any difficulty." And some such a remark like that, just showing that he was in contact with the situation all the time. And then he'd turn around to some other officer and make some remark about what had been going on in the Pacific as far as the Japs were concerned. He was keeping up to date with the two fronts continually and retaining it in his head. As I said before, I think he was a very, very intelligent individual. Question you ask about how he wore under pressure. Admiral King was under pressure all the time, not only from his underlings, but also from Congress and the Senate. Everyone was trying to tell him how the war should be performed. I think he let all that slip over his head and down his back like a water on a duck's back. He knew what he was doing, and he did it in his own way. And he handled Admiral Ingram and Nimitz with kid gloves, naturally. And everything went very, very smoothly as far as they were concerned. He stood up very well under pressure. I've never seen him completely frustrated, or I should say I've never seen him frustrated at all. He did everything in a very, very calm and smooth manner. On your next question, you asked about whether or not he had any close friends. Well, no, I really wasn't in a position to know that. I do know that he was very friendly with Admiral Nimitz and Admiral Richardson, and also with Admiral Ingram. But as far as intimate friends concerned, I'm afraid that I can't answer that question. That just about sums up my thoughts on the subject at the moment. I suppose after I ship this recording off to you, I'll begin to think of a lot more about Admiral King. I considered him a very great man. He did have a temper, as I've described in my previous discussion. But when he became calm inch, he seemed to be an entirely changed man. His responsibilities were so great I think he fully realized his responsibilities. But also in Admiral Nimitz and in Halsey and Spruance and his, various other commanders, he was able to delegate authority. And his chief of staff, C.M. Cook, was a man he could delegate authority to with without any feeling of concern. And of course, his deputy Dickie Edwards was a very fine character also. So he was surrounded by excellent men, but you must also remember that they were men of his own choosing. So that he knew what he was doing, and he knew what they could do. And the consequence, the war in the Pacific and the war in the Atlantic went just the way he wanted it to go. And as you know, it was successfully done. There were some mistakes made, that's quite obvious. I think Halsey's mistake was probably the worst one of the war. But as far as the Navy is concerned, at least, that was a terrible mistake, and I was unfortunate enough to be with Halsey in command of the Iowa at the time. But I don't know what Admiral King did at that particular moment or what reaction he had, because I was at sea as a captain, so I have no recollection of that at all. I remember before I went to his staff, one of his staff officers committed suicide. I heard from Admiral Lowe when I relieved him that Admiral King was extremely concerned about that, and he had a doctor assigned to the staff immediately. The doctor had each officer checked up every once in a while, and then he took a room in the area we had at the time and put in a gymnasium. And Admiral King didn't insist that his staff officers used it, but he suggested that they take time off during the day to go in and exercise on the various machines we had in there, and then afterwards get a shower, followed by a cold shower, and then come out and go to work somewhat refreshed. But that was a suggestion of the doctor, and Admiral King picked it up and had the arrangement executed immediately. I frequently went in exhausted from work. Perhaps I'd been up most of the night working at my desk with a good part of my staff, trying to figure out just where we'd send a convoy in order to dodge a submarine or a group of submarines, and waiting for results and so on. And during the forenoon, I would frequently go into that room and exercise on the machine. I used a sweatshirt and sweat trousers. And then I'd take a shower and get back into my clothes and go to work again, feeling quite considerably refreshed. So did others of the staff. I'd do the same thing. Admiral King thought that that was a good idea, and I think it was too. But it shows just another one of his traits, his feeling for the men who work for him. However, I do wish that you will have great success in writing this biography, and I hope when you finish that I will be able to obtain a copy, because as I've said before, I was very, very fond of Admiral King. As I said, I left his command with a great deal of regret, so I wish you the best of luck. Goodbye and good luck.